people want to find out more about Veterans for Peace, do you know how they could do that?
Yeah, and that address is veteransforpeace.org.
Great.
F-O-R spelled out, Veterans for Peace.
Great. Remind me of your name again so I can ask you. Helen...
Helen Jacquard.
Helen Jacquard. Okay. Well, Helen, we've been talking today with Helen Jacquard. This is KBOO Radio. We're sitting on the in the cabin, right? In the
yes.
cabin of the Golden Rule, which is a 34-foot sailboat that's sail all around the world for peace. It's been to the Marshall Islands back in the 50s trying to stop nuclear weapons, and it's still going strong. So, Helen, thanks so much for joining us today on KBOO.
Thank you very much, Emma. It was great to run into you today. What a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Great. Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported KBOO during our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign. With help from our community, we were able to reach our $75,000 goal, and we'll be able to continue bringing you grassroots, independent community radio. If you didn't get a chance to contribute, you can still support KBOO by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give. Join the team.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
In today's digital world, search engines are often seen as neutral tools that simply help us find information. But what if the results we get from these platforms aren't as unbiased as we think? What if they're shaped by hidden forces, reinforcing harmful stereotypes and limiting access to knowledge? This is the premise of Dr. Sophia Noble's groundbreaking book, Algorithms of Oppression. In her work, Dr. Noble examines how search engines, particularly Google, perpetuates biases that disproportionately impact marginalized groups, especially Black women. Her research challenges the idea that technology is a neutral force and instead reveals how it can reproduce and amplify systems of oppression. I began my conversation with Dr. Noble by asking what inspired her to write Algorithms of Oppression and what was the catalyst for her research into search engines and their biases.
Well, you know, I, like many people, when an economic recession happens, found myself going back to grad school. And I was, experiencing firsthand the effects of the housing crisis in 2006 to 2008. And I was leaving corporate America at a time when just about everybody I knew was losing their jobs, getting laid off, really struggling. And when I went into academia at that time, around 2008, I was so surprised at how people in the university were talking about these new big tech platforms that were emerging. I mean, they weren't as big as they are now. This is like the early days of Facebook, when it was you needed a .edu email to be on the platform, for example, and YouTube had just kind of taken off and exploded, and people were imagining a future with that. And people in academia were talking about these platforms as if they were kind of like things like the new public library or the future of how we would access knowledge and information, you know, almost like it was a public good. But I really knew from having been in corporate America that we were using search engines in particular to just like make our clients more visible. And I really understood them as advertising technologies, not as the new public library. And that dissonance between what I had experienced leaving industry and coming into academia was really the, I guess that was just like the place that I wanted to investigate. And I was thinking, honestly, at first, what would it mean that these tech companies would decide, let's say, what the history of Black knowledge and experience and culture would be, right? That people would start to use a search engine to look for Black people and Black culture, Black history, Black knowledge, and it would be whatever the programmers decided it would be. And that was the thing that got me. And I started doing a number of searches on, well, I guess probably the most infamous one that I've done and written about was what happened when you did keyword searches on Black girls and Black women. And back then, you got almost exclusively pornography as the representation of Black girls and women. And that really was the catalyst where I said, I need to write in detail for the public and for my colleagues in academia about what a search engine is in terms of it being an advertising technology, but more importantly, what are the stakes of turning to these kinds of technologies as a guide for the future of our kind of information ecosystem or the future of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Backing up a bit for the listening audience, break down what algorithms are. I think most people understand search engines at this point, but what are algorithms in regards to your research and what you discovered and how they work in particular?
I love that question because now here it is, you know, I don't know, we're many, many years, a decade and a half since I started this research. And a lot of people understand maybe colloquially the word algorithms. They know that it means, let's say, something a computer is doing or something software is doing to affect the kinds of experience we have online. And really, in the most technical sense, an algorithm is a set of instructions that we give to a computer to have it create a set of results for us. Okay. So, you know, you could think of it like a recipe. It's a set of instructions. That's ultimately what algorithms do. They're mathematical instructions, in fact. And they run every dimension of how we experience the internet or things on our smartphones or in computers on a daily basis. So there's an algorithm that is a set of instructions that's helping determine the shortest route in traffic if you're using a GPS tool or map tool, right? In the case of 2008, 9, 10, when I started this research, people really didn't understand what an algorithm was. It was very much computer science jargon. It was the kind of thing information scientists and computer scientists used to understand how programming was going to affect the development of a platform or a piece of software. And now, of course, what we really understand is that an algorithm is driving. You could almost think of it as the set of instructions that's going to over-determine how we experience the internet. And there's lots of different kinds of algorithms from simple to complex that we experience every time we're using computers. But we're also, even if we're not using computers, now that so many industries, schools, banks, landlords, you name it, are using software to make decisions, it means that all of us, in one way or another, are having decisions that affect our everyday lives determined by algorithms.
Now, knowing that, going back to your initial search for Black women, Black girls, the first thing that would pop up would be pornography. How particularly harmful do you think these algorithms are to certain groups or communities based on your research? And even though you did all this research for the book years ago, has there been a change in regards to the way in which algorithms play into maybe producing a certain level of harm or misinformation targeting certain communities and groups as well?
I love that question, because I have to say that we know a lot about media and how it affects us and how it affects societies and communities, different age groups, different demographics. One of the things, for example, that we know about television after more than 50 years of really good research around television is that when you experience racist or sexist or discriminatory stereotypes in something like television or film, you know that it has impact on audiences. It has negative impact on the people who are the subjects, right? So if it's a racist algorithm toward African Americans, then those stereotypes circulating in our society and people acting upon their negative beliefs about African Americans will do things like embolden racism or discrimination in our society. At UCLA, we have our Ralph J. Bunche Center, and one of our professors, who's also happens to be our interim chancellor right now, has led the Hollywood Diversity Report for more than a decade, with very rich research about what happens when people are misrepresented in Hollywood. Now, I was looking at that research and I was thinking about the internet and what's different about the internet when you experience derogatory images about yourself or other people. In this case, I was thinking about my daughter. You know, at the time that I was doing this research, she was a tween, and I was thinking, well, what happens when she is using a search engine and she's looking for things that other Black girls are interested in and she sees all this pornography? In that context, unlike a movie or a television show, what we're led to believe is that a search engine is bringing back to us the most reliable, the most credible, and the most truthful information, websites, and other kinds of resources. Now, that's a totally different context than knowing that Hollywood is making movies based on, you know, how much money they can make. Most people who use the internet and search engines think that they're looking, smarter people in Silicon Valley have developed these technologies to help them wade through millions of websites to bring back the very top 20, you know, the very best ones to that first page of search result. And that context of believing that what you find in a search engine is fair, reliable, truthful, credible, really, to me, is so important to study and understand. Because what that means is that not just my daughter, when she sees derogatory images about Black girls and women, but also her peers, her teachers, her employers, you know, anybody who also gets those kinds of results. And in fact, I have been at scholarly conferences in the early days of my research where I would say, well, look at how these algorithms are programmed so negatively toward Black women. And scholars themselves would stand up and say, well, maybe Black women just do more porn, which of course we know is just patently false. So the strong belief that what we get in search is very reliable is the reason why we have to interrogate what's happening there. And in course, we see this translated to the second part of your question in politics, when people are looking for information about political candidates or political issues, search engines are just ripe for misinformation, propaganda, disinformation to flow through those systems, because ultimately political action committees or candidates, campaigns that have the most money can really affect what we see in the first page or the first couple of pages of search results. And so these are resources that I think we've been encouraged to rely upon when we know very little, in fact, generally speaking, in the public about how they work.
I'm so happy you said that, because I mean, listening to you immediately, I was thinking misinformation, in particular, because I think most people don't really understand how this stuff is working. And the thought initially would be, this is a computer, it's smarter than me. But what people are failing to realize is that it's this computer generated information that we're pulling up is actually being programmed by human beings.
Absolutely. That's actually the most important dimension of remembering that, you know, everything we experience in the world, for the most part, I think outside of the natural environment, and even that is increasingly manipulated by human beings. You know, these are products of our imagination. And they're also limited by our imagination or lack thereof. I mean, we know that there are a lot of things that Silicon Valley companies do not test for, that they don't even think about looking at. We know that they don't hire, for the most part, underrepresented ethnic minorities. They don't hire women, generally speaking, certainly not as reflected in our population. So we have a narrow kind of mostly homogenous type of person who's working in Silicon Valley, who's just not asking the kinds of questions, certainly that I was asking in my research. And, you know, in the book Algorithms of Oppression, there are just dozens of examples of highly consequential problems that happen when you're doing all kinds of different searching. And what we know is that since that book came out in 2018, the companies work very hard to try to fix those problems. So there are a number of different kinds of, you know, damaging effects, and people have to have both made those damaging effects. Companies, unfortunately, have also profited quite a bit from the damage. And yet when it's time to take responsibility or accountability for the harm that comes from those products, somehow then it seems to just be articulated as, it's just the computer code. We're not really sure what happened here.
You're listening to Dr. Noble, the author of Algorithms of Oppression. Now back to the show. Dr. Noble reminds us that while search engines provide quick answers, they also can erode our ability to engage in deep critical thinking necessary to navigate complex political landscapes. This shift in how we access and process information has profound implications for democracy, shaping how we understand power, history, and the decisions we make at the ballot box. To dive deeper, I asked Dr. Noble, were there specific patterns or findings that she found especially troubling about how political information is being filtered or shaped by these algorithms?
Well, one thing we know is that all of these technologies have really truncated our ability to do kind of that deep dive or long form reading and preparation and research. I'll tell you that it's hard for me to find a colleague who's a professor or a teacher who doesn't comment at some point on how difficult it is to get students to read a lot of information or material. It's increasingly difficult to assign, long articles and books, things that would have been like so easy 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Okay, so this kind of socialization around instant information, thin reading, nuggets, bite-sized bits of information, for sure impacts our ability as voters or people just interested in all kinds of things to really be able to go deep. It also leaves us vulnerable as we're kind of losing our ability to concentrate and focus on long form reading and deeper diving. We're also living in a time where our time and ability to access other people for discussion and conversation about issues is also declining. We know, for example, there's lower participation in organized religion. That might be a place where people would go and talk about politics or issues or things that are happening in their communities. People are increasingly isolated. The whole ecosystem of how we live now has compressed our time and concentration and ability to think deeply about the consequences of who we're voting for, what we're voting on. So I think in some ways, while we can just search for something like, okay, what is this proposition about? Or what is this candidate about? Or should I even vote or not? In some ways, we feel like we have more access than ever. We also, in other ways, have kind of lost other types of access or other types of knowledge and thinking and time. And I think those are very important things to consider. You know, we may have more information at our fingertips than we ever had before, but it is also increasingly difficult to make sense of what's fact, what's fiction, what we can count on, and how it's going to affect our lives.
In an era where misinformation spreads with a single click and voting rights remain under attack, the stakes for civic participation have never been higher. I turn to Dr. Noble for her insights on how voter suppression tactics are evolving and what it means for Black communities.
We want to remember that before the 2016 presidential election, Black people in particular, specifically, have been targeted with propaganda and disinformation to effectively discourage our political participation. We have people who are paid actors, paid influencers to discourage our participation in electoral politics, to encourage us to withhold our vote. We've also had massive voter disenfranchisement, purging of millions of African Americans off the voting rolls. So that is also, you know, part of like what you and I experience in our families and in our communities, where people are like, you know, I don't even know, like, this party's taking my vote for granted, and I'm going to withhold until they do right. Those are voter suppression tactics that people may not even be aware. Very smart people are also vulnerable to that kind of thing. So I just think, you know, we have to get more sophisticated and nuanced ourselves about what it means to take away our right to vote, even by convincing us that there's nobody good to vote for. And there also may not be somebody good to vote for.
Algorithms that lift up misinformation can fuel apathy among Black voters, using psychological and social strategies to discourage political participation. Propaganda may amplify the belief that voting doesn't lead to meaningful change in Black communities by highlighting systemic failures and unfulfilled promises. This overloading of negative messaging can also lead to serious emotional exhaustion and voter fatigue, making individuals feel overwhelmed and powerless to make a difference. But checking out of the political process is a slap in the face to those who fought hard for the right to vote.
Some of us are old enough to remember the stories of our own parents not being able to vote. Okay, so I think for people, let's say Generation X and older, maybe really understand the sacrifices that were made by the generation before us,
right,
to have the right to vote. And it's not like they had a lot of incredible choices, because after the Civil War, when Black men had the right to vote, there were more Black mayors in the United States than we've ever had in the history of this country. And you had massive Black voter participation coming kind of post-Reconstruction. And that was met in the 1920s with the, you know, basically the Reign of Terror, the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, the perverse and profane lynchings that took place all over this country. And again, tactics to suppress and roll back Black people's voting participation and rights. And it was our parents who then were, and Black women who were finally given the right to vote with the passage of the 1964 Voting Rights Act. So when young people say, we have a right to not participate, that's true. But when I think about how much blood has been spilled in this country over the profound impact that Black people could have when we did vote, then that's another way of thinking about just what it means to withhold a vote It's not just symbolic and it's not just about representation. It's that when Black people vote, we actually control the electorate in a lot of places where we live and can affect incredible change and empowerment. So that's another way to think about what it means to opt out.
Given the power of search engines and shaping public discourse, what are some solutions or interventions that could help mitigate the negative impacts of search engines on the electoral process?
Well, one thing we need are more search engines, not a handful of monopolies that really control the information landscape. And there are people who are trying to think about, what are ways that you could access information that is more aligned with your values rather than more aligned with what's most profitable for the companies to show you. I've always been, a proponent since I started this research of more search engines that are specialized, that really help us to parse deep and difficult information, like voting information at a local level. I remember even in this last election, sitting with my family and are trying to deeply investigate people and propositions and ballot initiatives, and it was very difficult. And I, in the old days, we used to have like the progressive voter guides, and even those are hard to find and work your way through. So more education, more expertise that can be made visible by different kinds of technologies is far better than just those with the most money being able to surface. And of course, I'm an educator, I'm a professor, so I believe that there should be, deep information and education that we can, no matter what your politics are.
Last question, what can individuals and communities do to push back against algorithmic oppression based on your research and work and what you know to be fact at this point?
One of the most powerful inoculations, I think, for the public is for them to understand what these systems are, how they work. Of course, my book is just one foray into understanding, and that book is very accessible. It's not written so that you have to have a PhD to understand it, I promise. But knowledge is a very powerful inoculator. It helps you to slow down, think more critically, have conversations with people and experts that you trust, people who have knowledge. That I don't just mean credentialed experts. I mean people with lived experience, deeper knowledge than you do about something. All of those are different forms of inoculation. Not just trusting everything that you come into contact with online or even the systems that you're using. I think people can use their voice and their power to support libraries and librarians. Quite frankly, those are great places to go to continue to build our knowledge and our own stores of wisdom. And I think we want to also do everything we can to kind of protect access to education, increase access to education. I mean, these are decisions we often make at a local and a state level. And participating everywhere we can in understanding that if we just leave our country and our culture to Silicon Valley to decide and to shape, we're really going to lose a lot. We're already losing a lot of knowledge about how to do things. And we think of this as, maybe parochial, but I will tell you that knowing how to do things is very valuable. At the end of the day, what happens when the power grid goes down and you can't use your phone and you can't use the internet and you can't use a search engine? Do you know how to do things? Are you in community with others who know how to do things? All of that to me is part of the inoculation that we can control, at least in our own personhood. Of course, we can also, as workers on our jobs, we can organize on our jobs and respond to more encroachments of technology companies and impacting how our work is changing and the quality of our work is changing. you know, companies are shifting a lot of money and budget toward tech, and that budget is coming away from workers and workers' wages. So there's lots of places. You don't have to be a technologist to care about what's happening with this sector and how it's affecting your life. And there are many places where you can have a voice and push back and do something different.
Well, Dr. Noble, this has been a great conversation really about digital literacy. So again, thank you so much. And especially the point that you mentioned about us being a community. When we think about the next 4 years, that's going to be more important and significant than ever. You know, who do we go to? How do we access information, resources? Because considering what's been already said, and he's been proven to do it, you know, if he says something, he most likely will do it. So I just think everything you said, and then considering how algorithms work and search engines and technology, I couldn't be more happy and pleased that I had this conversation with you. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you again so much.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your work. I will tell you that journalism is one of the most important resources that we have. And I'm just so grateful for you and your work.
I'm Anita Johnson. I spoke with Dr. Sophia Noble, Professor of Gender Studies, African American Studies, and Information Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. Professor Noble is the author of the best-selling book on racist and sexist algorithmic harm in commercial search engines, titled Algorithms of Oppression: How Search Engines Reinforce Racism.
Talk, don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go.
Big shout out to Anita and Davey D.
Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah.
Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though.
Yeah.
Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on, check out.
Why every knob just think they hard not when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till they're ready from the steel gray beats. They bleed. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to their lovers, I lay with a please. Make some shade on your name in the street. You go. It ain't David D.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best. In the West,
yes, Coast, Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
James Earl Carter, 1924-2024. His name, James Earl Carter Jr., was not a famous one, for few knew him by that name. But millions knew him by his nickname, his high voltage smile, and his Georgia accent as Jimmy Carter, American president. Of all the modern presidents, he was perhaps the smartest, as he dabbled in nuclear physics and found his footing in politics after the scandal of Watergate as a political outsider. But in political terms, because he lost re-election, he was treated as a political leper. Carter, known as an avatar of human rights, lived a remarkable post-presidency, as much as did his wife, Rosalynn, who served the poor by building thousands of houses, treated chronic diseases in Africa, and monitored elections worldwide. His recent death, after 100 years of life, marked a truly remarkable life. His 1980s election loss, the former actor Ronald Reagan, also marked a turning point in American politics. Why? Carter lost in part because the Iranians took American hostages and held them until Reagan took office. Some political observers say high inflation was also a factor, but that wasn't the real reason. Carter lost principally because when he first ran for the presidency, he won some 75% of the white evangelical vote. When he ran for re-election, that number had fallen to around 25%, which meant a fall of some 50 points. No politician can survive such a plunge. Carter announced and aired his support for civil rights. White evangelicals fled in terror. Why? Because for them, Christianity meant whiteness, and segregation was in furtherance of whiteness. Think of recent evangelical support for Trump. Evangelicals equals whiteness. It did then, it does now. Seen in this light, black liberation amounts to anathema. A little lesson from history. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Hard Knock Radio. Rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
I really would like your undivided attention, please, for immortal technique. Check, check, check. All right, brother. I remember I was watching a special. It was like the rocker with tight puto jeans. I remember making fun of each other about where we come from, one style versus another. But I want to say something to you because something that was in this comedy sketch really alerted me. It was a sketch that Culture Clash was doing, and it was about Che Guevara coming back in the modern age. And it was interesting, but it was also sad because at the end of the sketch, he dies. He dies fomenting a rebellion that doesn't come to fruition. He grows angry, he goes down to a Taco Bell or something, and he shoots it up, and the police come in full force, and they come at him, and they destroy him. And what I thought was very interesting about this sketch is that it shows us how revolutionary tactics have to be upgraded. That as much as we remember and appreciate, as much as we remember and appreciate the heroes that are our elders, that are our ancestors, that came before us, we cannot put them so high on a pedestal so as not to learn from their errors, from their mistakes, from the problems that occurred in their time that they were not capable of dealing with, because people will look back on our struggle now and say, remember the sound strike, remember when Arizona fell to the fascists, what could have been done better, what could have been more concise, who could we have included in our struggle to strengthen our ranks, who could we have shown to show people and go to the Jewish community and say, remember when they burned your books? Now they're burning ours. We could have gone to the Islamic community and said, do you know the way that you're demonized in all of television programming? Look at the way our people are demonized constantly every day. Make no mistake about it. It's not that they don't want us here. Get that thought out of your mind. They want us here. They want us here to take care of their children. They want us here to wash their clothes. They want us here to pick their food. They want us here to clean their houses. They want us here to take care of their families and to raise the next generation of their children. What they don't want us to do is to stay on the land that ancestrally has belonged to us before there was such thing as a Muslim, a Christian, a Jewish person, and I dare say a Hindu. Because we have been on this side of the world for millennia. I think what is incredibly important for us to acknowledge about our struggle is that we cannot only include race in it, but also class. If we had more affluent people from our community that didn't identify with the economic policies of the oppressor as the only functional mechanism to get out of debt, to get out of the oppressive nature of a capitalist system, then we would not be in this situation. The other problem is that we keep reading the same book from 100 years ago written by dead Russian people thinking that's the only way to get our solution to a problem. And it is not the only way. And I'm not saying this to denigrate anybody's ideology. No, I'm just telling you that we were colonized by several different means. We were colonized by an economic system where we were politically de-evolved and economically de-evolved. We were colonized by ruining the relationship with our women. Our women used to be our equals. Now we look at them as lesser in all societies, sexually objectified, taken down to such a level that men think to themselves, man, I want to have a son. I don't want to have a daughter. To the point where we say to ourselves, out of all of our cultural values, they've been removed. Our past religion. I remember when I go speak about Middle Eastern affairs, I say to you and to the Muslim student unions, I say, you know what, imagine if Iraq was really invaded the way our lands were invaded. Imagine if someone took your country over and convinced you that the Quran was a fairy tale, that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be unto him, didn't really exist, but he was a fantasy, a mythology. What if someone came to America, conquered America, and all these good-hearted, ignorant Christian people that believe in something so great and have such a powerful faith, what if someone convinced them and took advantage of their ignorance and beat them down to the point that they convinced them that Jesus was just a story, that he wasn't real at all, and that he never was real, and that nothing happened? That's exactly what happened to our people. Our gods, our tradition, everything that makes us what we are was stolen from us long ago. And rather than trying to recreate the past by trying to have another cacique voted into office or elevating an Aztec emperor out of the most affluent of our people, what we need to realize is that the structure of our society in the pre-Columbian era was such in a pyramid shape that all they had to do was remove the top and everything else fell apart. Because they believed that divine origin created rule, that God in heaven above, the Son of Sons, had decreed that one person should lead every single other. It was a form of imperialism. It was a form of fascism in itself some ways. It was a form that we need to accept was taken advantage of. Because it was not the Spanish steel that conquered us. It was not the bullets. It was the diseases. It was the lies. It was the trickery. It was the turning clan against clan, tribe against tribe, nation against nation, brother against brother, sister against sister. That is what defeated our people. We aided in our own occupation, in our own colonization, and that hurts to acknowledge, but it's true. In the same way we have aided in the destruction of our family values, in the destruction of our household, we have forgotten what made us the proud people that we are. And now it is time to reclaim it, not by just looking at the past, but realizing the errors of the past and adopting them with the future. Everything must evolve. I tell this when I do gang summits. I tell the brothers, listen, if we don't evolve, if you don't evolve, you will suffer the same fate as everything else in the world that has not evolved. You will become extinct. Our people will become extinct. Your children's children will wake up and not know who they are or where they came from, and the only thing to identify themselves will be this mysterious brown skin and legends of the past that don't make sense to them anymore. If that is our destiny, then we should all find a grave to lie down in right now. But I don't feel that we have a defeatist attitude in this crowd. I feel that we have a positive attitude. I hear Aslan Underground talking about revolution and about turning the tables on them and realizing that we need to stand up as a people, as a united people. I hear acts that are both rock and roll, hip hop. I hear people that don't even do music that come to these events that speak their heart and really want to help and do everything that they possibly can. And that shows me that our community has not forsaken, has not forsaken revolution. And by revolution, I mean a complete cycle, not just one insane push for power, because if we don't replace a system with something better, then our revolution has failed. If we overturn a government and put ourselves where the king sat, then what revolution have we really achieved? What have we really done for our people to create a better future? I know that the sound strike has been working for a long time to show people the monetary value, the cultural value that we have. Talking with Javier Gonzalez, with other people that have worked painstakingly, we've also decided that there are people within the state of Arizona that we will work with, that we will do shows with. There are people behind enemy lines that we need to keep into constant communication with, that we should keep in touch with on Facebook or Twitter or wherever that is, like outside to socially believe yourselves these days. You know, it's funny because the evolution of socialization is also something we need to discuss too. Socializing online is to socializing as reality TV is to reality. You need to reach out and physically be there to see it. You need to physically see the border at some point. That will be our pilgrimage to Mecca. That border that was created 100-odd years ago, a war fought under false premise, nations annexed, people told that they were no longer indigenous, that they were alien, to a place that their ancestors had lived on for thousands of years. This is a great crime. This is a great lie. This is a great fairy tale told to our people. They tell us every single day that they're only enforcing the law. We just want to enforce the law, enforce the law. Slavery was once the law. A law being in place doesn't mean that it's just. It means that people have allowed it to exist because it's been financially beneficial. It's financially beneficial for them to keep our people as slave labor on a timely basis, to be there working in the fields during the harvest season, and then get the fight up when you want the same inalienable rights as all American citizens, which we're due to. We fight in their wars. Our indigenous people go fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, and still they don't have citizenship. And so then the question becomes, what makes a true American? Is the fact that you fell out of a vagina somewhere in Kansas or in Wisconsin or in Colorado make you an American? Or is it the fact that you can actually speak about the good and negative aspects of what America has done as a nation? America is, after all, in my mind, not a great Satan. It's a middleman. It finds little Satans to do its work for them. It's the king that can't do anything. The king can only move one square in chess. The queen can move very many squares. The knight moves in an odd shape. The rook has its lineage. It needs other people to do its work for them. It's needed our people to do its work for them. It's needed a Trujillo. It's needed a Somoza. It's needed a We were going to get to him, but I want to use somebody more specific now. It's needed present Mexican presidents. It needs present Colombian presidents. It needs people that are far right in their agenda to create the idea that displacing indigenous people is something normal and not reactionary. That destroying indigenous communities is perfectly acceptable because these people are quote-unquote savages, and that we have no true link to that culture. And then we begin to ask ourselves, what does it truly mean to be a so-called Latino, as we're all marked in the media? Well, Latino just means that you speak a Latin-based language. Under that premise, Romanians would be Latino. French people would be Latino. And confront the racism in your own community, that means that Haitians would be Latino. Let's touch on that topic for a second. Without the Haitian Revolution, there is no Latin American Revolution. They were the first example for our people. And I love the legacy of Simón Bolívar. But no pun intended, call a spade, he turned his back on François Toussaint. He made a deal for his land. We have to acknowledge the good and the bad that has come of this. We need to acknowledge that when we discuss a movement and we call it a reconquista, that's a very important word. La Reconquista comes from the 15th century when the Spaniards were retaking Spain in their holy war, in the crusade that is left out of history. And that afterwards they signed the Alhambra Decree. The Alhambra Decree, when you read it, exiles all Jews immediately from Spain, calls for the forcible conversion of all people that are Islamic or Jewish or of any other faith except the Catholic one. It indoctrinates people with the idea that it's okay to enslave people if they are infidel. That is the beginning of the modern interpretation of racism. Because when you look at the civilizations of antiquity, Roman Greece didn't have the same cancer of racism that then their children's children would have. They respected talent when they saw it, and no further proof is necessary than to see that there were African emperors of Rome, African popes. That Barack Obama is not the first black man to ever hold a position of power. These are things you need to educate yourself with. So when they attack you, you have the weapons. Holding a gun and running into a Taco Bell is not the weapon you need now. It may be someday, if it comes down to that, but I pray it doesn't. Because I was told by a great man, Russell Means, that old women or old men and mothers know the folly of war. That young people think it's a glorious thing to die for your country, when in reality you leave a hole in the family, a gap in it. And while it may be very easy to romanticize dying for revolution, it's much harder. It takes more cojones to live the rest of your life for revolution. To dedicate yourself to an idea. To believe in your heart that what we dream here in this room is possible one day. And I know it will be, because I know no one here has a quitter spirit, and I know no one will fail. I'm not going to speak anymore. I'm going to get the finger up and let you enjoy the party. I'm going to have people come back on here and go crazy and ballistic, and I want you to enjoy yourselves tonight. I want you to feel the rhythm of the music. I want you to laugh at this motherfucker, funny ass jokes, because he's hysterical. I want you to get all the uncultured laughter. I want y'all to realize that the more we build as a community and the greater love that we have for our people in our struggle, both the good and the bad aspects of what we have, and we acknowledge that, the stronger we become. The more we deny our faults of the past, the weaker we become. The more we're unable to realize who the real enemy is. Because it's not just out there. It's also inside here. Inside every individual is the gentle complacency that we find in failure. That I've done enough for today.
At Camp David, demand payment for New Orleans with the best of swordsmen, launching missiles at the White House while tanks performing on the lawn, and I just let them burn till death's confirmed. Laid to rest with worms, cause otherwise they'll never learn. I form a coup attempt with anthrax through the fence. From out a package I got in the mail that you just sent. But I got a better punishment for these Republicans. I'd let them live so they can see us overthrow the government. Let's with them, have the First Lady till my launch, then I across her face like Peter North. And I won't leave a doubt what we about when I leave a trout bleeding out on Condoleezza's couch. I'll seek this route without regrets and drink a brew that think of you. Cause if it's the last f***ing thing I do, I'll percent of the World Bank is owned by the U.S. Treasury. Robbing third world countries out all their resources and equity. When Afghanistan was fighting the Russians, Reagan and Bush gave Bin Laden weapons and told them get the bussing. We even called them freedom fighters. Financed the cost with CIA important. That whole Iran-Contra scandal took the blame. Started a war on drugs. Meanwhile, Russia's defeated. America thinks more oil for us. Takeover set up a puppet government. A rather barren
freedom fighters. George W. call them terrorists. Poetic justice, payback to these hypocrites like Bill O'Reilly. Right wingers deserve what they get. Rush Limbaugh, drug addict Giuliani, sex scandal. I wanna thank white supremacists and show you how my handle my next nano technologically designed. This bitch sauce to all you stupid ass execs at Capitol resign. Children from the Senate and Congress, pompous religious right, made suicidal when I exposed Josephus for ghost
letter. Ha! Hey, hey, ho, 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 knock radio. East, west, north, south, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous. Speaking to the thugs, one love. We know where y'all at. Ha! Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415's bumping hard knock radio. Brown Buffalo, rah, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor guy. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor guy. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. I always had a daydream, the poet Elizabeth Bishop wrote to her friend Robert Lowell, of being a lighthouse keeper, absolutely alone. Bishop lived on islands and near the shore as often as she could, Nantucket and Cuttyhunk off Massachusetts, Nova Scotia and Newfoundland, Key West, North Haven Island in Maine. Here is a poem published in The New Yorker in 1947 that pertains to the new year, distills many years of Bishop's seaside meditations, and evokes the clarity of meaning contained in personal encounter with the world ocean. At the fish houses. Although it is a cold evening, down by one of the fish houses, an old man sits netting, his net in the gloaming almost invisible, a dark purple-brown, and his shuttle worn and polished. The air smells so strong of codfish it makes one's nose run and one's eyes water. The five fish houses have sharply peaked roofs and narrow, cleated gangplanks that slant up to storerooms in the gables for the wheelbarrows to be pushed up and down on. All is silver, the heavy surface of the sea, swelling slowly as if considering spilling over, is opaque, but the silver of the benches, the lobster pots and masts scattered among the wild, jagged rocks, is of an apparent translucence like the small old buildings with an emerald moss growing on their shoreward walls. The big fish tubs are completely lined with layers of beautiful herring scales, and the wheelbarrows are similarly plastered with creamy iridescent coats of mail, with small iridescent flies crawling on them. Up on the little slope behind the houses, set in the sparse, bright sprinkle of grass, is an ancient wooden capstan, cracked, with two long bleached handles, and some melancholy stains like dried blood where the ironwork has rusted. The old man accepts a lucky strike. He was a friend of my grandfather. We talk of the decline in the population and of codfish and herring while he waits for a herring boat to come in. There are sequins on his vest and on his hands. He has scraped the scales, the principal beauty, from unnumbered fish with that black old knife, the blade of which is almost worn away. Down at the water's edge, at the place where they haul up the boats, up the long ramp descending into the water, thin silver tree trunks are laid horizontally across the gray stones, down and down, at intervals of 4 or 5 feet. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, element bearable to no mortal, to fish and to seals. One seal particularly, I've seen here evening after evening. He was curious about me. He was interested in music. like me, a believer in total immersion, so I used to sing him Baptist hymns. I also sang A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. He stood up in the water and regarded me steadily, moving his head a little. Then he would disappear, then suddenly emerge almost in the same spot, with a sort of shrug, as if it were against his better judgment. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, the clear, gray, icy water. Back behind us, the dignified, tall firs begin, bluish, associating with their shadows. A million Christmas trees stand waiting for Christmas. The water seems suspended, above the rounded gray and blue-gray stones. I've seen it over and over, the same sea, the same, slightly, indifferently swinging above the stones, icily free above the stones and then the world. If you should dip your hand in, your wrist would ache immediately. Your bones would begin to ache and your hand would burn as if the water were a transmutation of fire that feeds on stones and burns with a dark gray flame. If you tasted it, it would first taste bitter, then briny, then surely burn your tongue. It is like what we imagine knowledge to be. Dark, salt, clear, moving, utterly free, drawn from the cold, hard mouth of the world, derived from the rocky breasts forever, flowing and drawn, and since our knowledge is historical, flowing and flown. Best wishes for the new year from World Ocean Radio and the World Ocean Observatory.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio KBOO 90.7.
This is Bird Note. When writer Amy Tan started journaling about nature, she wasn't trying to write another bestseller. It was 2016, and she was searching for an escape from the overt racism she felt was being directed toward her and other Asian Americans.
That was never meant to be anything more than a place for me to put my questions down and my observations. It wasn't until my editor said we should publish it that it became a book.
As she spent more time in nature, she started to fall in love with birds.
The type of love I feel for them is so special because I don't experience it with any human being or other wildlife. And it's the very fact that it is wild and it doesn't fly off in my presence. And they look at me and continue to do what they're doing. It's a feeling of acceptance.